From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The man remembered that my husband was a well-known prominent doctor in Havana, and he decided it wasn't very good for the police station to make a son of this person disappear.
Two views of Cuba. One woman remembers what it was like before the revolution. A man talks about what it is like today.
People life worse now because the hospital and the schools are not all life. The life are another things. The life is liberty. The life is can talk. The life is can travel freely.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton is ready to unveil a $20 billion plan to improve child care and make it more affordable. Administration officials say the package Clinton is announcing today would boost tax credits and expand several existing programs to help parents obtain quality care. The plan is the second of three Clinton proposals to lead off the new year. Yesterday, he proposed expanding Medicare to early retirees and displaced workers. Friday, he'll launch an education initiative during a trip to Texas. President Clinton's forum on race goes to Arizona next week, but critics charge the discussion is ducking some key issues. The Phoenix session will focus on race in the workplace, with praise for diversity programs at several Arizona companies. But some minority leaders say they feel shunned. They note that affirmative action and immigration are not on the agenda. They also say ignoring more controversial issues will only compound racial tensions. The head of the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce says no issues should be off limits. The White House is downplaying the criticism. Despite the limited focus of the Phoenix Forum, officials say attendees will get the chance to bring up any racial issue they want. This news from Denver, the strain is showing in the jurors deliberating the fate of Terry Nichols. Two panel members were in tears last night when the judge told them to return today for a third day of deliberations. The jury is deciding whether Nichols should die for his role in the Oklahoma City bombing. Another study concludes that eating fish is good for your heart. The research in the Journal of the American Medical Association suggests that a single meal of fish a week sharply cuts the risk of sudden cardiac death. President Clinton's use of the line item veto was overturned by a federal judge in a case involving pension plans for federal workers. The judge accepted an administration union deal restoring workers' ability to switch plans later this year. Two other legal challenges to the new veto powers are pending. A federal judge has struck down key portions of a California law limiting campaign contributions that was approved as a ballot initiative last year. The judge said the limits, $500 per statewide election from most donors, were too low to pass constitutional muster. The UN plans to pull most peacekeepers from Angola by the end of the month, keeping a token force of 500. The troops were to have left in November, but UNITA resisted giving a diamond area to the government. The Cayman Islands has refused to allow a cruise ship chartered for gay men to make a one-day stop in port, saying research and experience has shown that such passengers wouldn't uphold standards of, quote, appropriate behavior. Gay and civil rights groups outraged called the action discrimination. The Cayman's Minister of Tourism, Commerce and Transport wrote that careful research and prior experience has led us to conclude we cannot count on this group to uphold the standards of appropriate behavior expected of visitors to the Cayman Islands, so we regrettably cannot offer our hospitality. The ship is headed to Belize instead. The Denny's restaurant chain faces new discrimination complaints. A group of corrections officers claimed they were turned away twice from a Denny's in South Florida. Six of the officers in the group are African American. One of the officers tells the Miami Herald that the restaurant manager told them the place had run out of food and also said, quote, "You guys don't look right together." The officers complained to the company's headquarters. A company spokesperson says Denny's is committed to diversity. Denny's is already the subject of a civil rights monitor because of a 1994 discrimination case. That case stemmed from an incident at a Maryland Denny's involving black Secret Service agents assigned to President Clinton. Heading off criticism that it was planning an unbalanced celebration of Israel's 50th anniversary, the Smithsonian Institution says it will scrap the proposed events and develop new ones. The Smithsonian was criticized because it had been working with only one American Jewish group that is considered a liberal organization advocating religious pluralism and better relations between Jews and Palestinians. South Africa's last hardline apartheid president, P.W. Botha, is to be prosecuted for defying a subpoena to appear before the Truth Commission, this according to prosecutors today. Truth and Reconciliation Commission Chair Archbishop Desmond Tutu laid charges against Botha on December 19th for failing to appear before the body to testify on the activities of the State Security Council, which imposed a state of emergency in the 1980s in efforts to maintain white rule. Botha ruled South Africa from 1984 until he handed over power in 1989 to F.W. de Klerk. That's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Cuban Revolution was and is one of the seminal events of the 20th century. It changed the political life of an entire hemisphere and directly affected millions of lives. And as Cuba prepares to welcome Pope John Paul II, today on Democracy Now! We're going to take a look at two of those lives. In the past week, I had a chance to go down to Havana, Cuba, and speak with many different people. In our first and second segment, we're going to hear from Dr. Rosa Antich Coro. She's a retired professor of English at the University of Havana. She was one of the few wealthy Cubans who threw her lot in with the revolution back in 1959 and decided not to leave the country. Her father was a tobacco landowner and a factory owner, her mother a sugarcane plantation owner. Rosa Antich is presently the ideologist with her local committee in defense of the revolution, known as CDRs. She helps explain the rules that are laid out by the ruling party in Cuba to her neighbors. Both her husband and her son-in-law were members of and are members of the ruling Communist Party. After we hear from Dr. Antich, we're going to talk to Carlos. He is a Catholic engineer who just left his job because he said he couldn't make enough money. He'll express a great deal of dissatisfaction with the current government in Cuba. But first, Dr. Rosa Antich Coro.
I wanted to ask you about a little about the history of Cuba and the revolution. Were you born in Havana?
Yes, I was born in Havana, and I was 37 at the time of the revolution, so I have seen both times. I am now 76, so half my life has been lived without before the revolution, and the other half after the revolution.
I couldn't ask for more of an expert then. Mm-hmm. What did your family do, your parents?
My father owned a business, a cosmetics and soap business, so he could be called a petit bourgeoisie, or maybe even bourgeoisie. Mm-hmm. And I was sent to school in the United States, which is something that well-to-do families used to do, mm-hmm. send their children to, like, finishing school or something like that. Actually, I went to school in Florida, in St. Augustine, Florida, to be closer to Cuba.
What happened to your family when the revolution happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, they would not be expected very much to back the revolution because of their general extraction and so on. But Arnie, my son, was taken prisoner by one of Batista's henchmen when he was only 16 years old, and he was on the verge of being killed by these people. So it was by sheer coincidence that he didn't get killed. So my parents became very much against Batista. And then at the triumph of the revolution, then they became Fidelistas. And then they began to see. It was a little bit hard for them to understand the big changes at the beginning, because my father owned not only his own business, but he also owned a lot of land, tobacco land, in Pinar del Rio province. And my mother owned sugarcane land in Matanzas province. So if they knew that things were going to get very hard. But as each of the laws began to be put into effect, I would explain them to them. Of course, they were people, they were well-read people and so on, but they were definitely right side, not left side. But they understood. They understood the need for change, and they understood the greatness of the work that was being done for changing the structures and having schools for all the children and having hospitals for the sick and all that kind of thing, because they were, well, humane before anything else, and they understood everything, and they both died being very faithful to the revolution.
What happened to Arnie? How was he taken captive?
Oh, that's a long story, and it was a very silly story. He had been, well, you know that he's a radio amateur, so he knew how to put radios together and put them together and...
ham radios.
Yes, but he knew how to prepare a radio for transmission, and he had done some of that for the subversive movement during Batista's time. He had done some of that, but he was also working at the ICR, El ICR, the radio and television company, and he bought a record at a record shop. And he started to walk into his work, into the building, and he was called by some men from a car, and he just turned around and said, are you speaking to me? And they took him by force, they put him into the car, and they took him to the police station. And he was taken to the police station of the worst henchmen of Batista's whole troop of henchmen. They thought that the record that he had, remember this was a time when people didn't go around with tape recorders or things like that. Nearly 40 years ago, there were some tape recorders, but they were the great big ones like that. And he was taken to the police station, and they said that the record was probably a subversive call to be given through the radio station. And then he was there for hours. He was questioned. He was only 16. He was questioned and questioned, and they were very, of course, very rough with him. And they started to send him to the dungeon. But then the head of the police station came, and he said, "Who is he?" And when he said his name, the man remembered that my husband was a well-known prominent doctor in Havana, and he decided it wasn't very good for the police station to make a son of this person disappear. So then he called our house, but this was about 20 hours that he was at the police station. Then he called our house, and then we came to pick him up, and we took him back home. All this time we were rushing around all over Havana trying to find where he was. Not only that, then we had my son, who was 14, sitting next to the phone waiting for such a phone call as we finally received. Then the following morning, my husband called me from his work. He went to work as usual. We got home about 3 o'clock in the morning. The following morning, my husband called, and he said, there have been 18 corpses found strewn all over the city of Havana. And most of them probably came from that place where our son had been. So you can imagine how we felt about it. That's an interesting thing. Huh?
So here were your parents, who were landowners, and as you said, who were certainly not left-leaning, who became Fidelistas, who became supporters of the revolution. What happened to their land, the tobacco land, the sugar? Mm-hmm.
Well, very soon it had to be given back to. They were supposed to keep only a very small part, and they were paid for the small part, for the other part that was taken. And I think it's a very interesting thing that my memory is the following: when I was a very young girl, there used to be some poor relatives of my mother, poor cousins, who came every 2 months, I think, or 3 months, I can't remember how often, and visited. They were, you know, poor relations, very, very humble, very modest. They came in and said, "Hello, how are you?" They sat down in the living room only after my mother told them to please sit down. And they took out some money and they gave it to my mother, because they were the people who had rented my mother's land my mother owned the land, and she had, and I was only 16, 17. I studied philosophy and letters, but I was not interested in politics, and I was, and nobody ever taught me or ever led me to read any of the, you know, left-wing things and so on. So, but I still, I felt that it was very strange that somebody would work, would toil the land, would come from the country and give my mother, who was sitting there in her living room, money for working her land. And so I maybe once or twice I told my mother that, and she just said, well, that's the way life is, and some people were born to be rich and some people were born to be poor, and that was it, you know. So I think I just accepted that very normally. I was thinking of young people, of dancing, of my friends, of studying, and I didn't pay much attention. So when the time came, when the land was given to those people, normally, I just sat down with my mother and I said, well, I think you've had enough of that money being brought to your living room for maybe 30, 40 years of your life. So now it should belong to them as it's going to from now on.
So it came to be owned by those very people?
Oh, yes. And then later, oh, and then if you want to hear the rest of the story, food became scarce. Food has been scarce since the beginning of the revolution, you know. I mean, before the revolution, some people ate a lot and other people didn't eat anything. They ate very poorly. So then trying to level up made food scarce for everybody. And bad management of the agriculture and things like that. You probably know about that. Well, anyway, then we had the ration book. My father died in 1962. My mother lived alone in an apartment very near me. So I saw her almost every day and we talked on the phone. And about once a month, one of those cousins, the poor relations from the country, came with a box and they brought her rice and plantains and things from their land to eat. So don't you think that's poetic justice? I've always thought that was a very interesting thing to happen to my mother. They brought her black beans and, things from their land, the mm-hmm. things that they collected for themselves, and they brought my mother so she would eat better. Mm-hmm. And also, we visited them occasionally. Gasoline has always been short, too, so it wasn't easy for us to decide to go. It was maybe a 3-hour drive or a 4-hour drive to go to the country, but you would have to use up the gasoline that you had for the whole month. Your gasoline ration, but sometimes we used it and we went to visit them, and they came. Even now, a few weeks ago, one of my old cousins came and sat there where you're sitting now, and some of them, most of them are good revolutionaries. Others have left. I mean, that's the way life is, you know. Some of them lived very poorly before, and now they live better, and then they wanted to live elsewhere, and to, as I say, to eat ham, and to eat drink, to eat chocolate, and things like that. So some have left, some are still here, and they come and visit, and we are perfect equals. Before, besides having them come and bring my mother the money and so on, we gave them all our cast-off clothes. That was one of the things, you know, and they went off very happy with the things that I wasn't going to wear anymore. They were not torn or anything. They were perfectly good things, but we weren't going to wear them anymore. So that was part of the relation. You want another story? I had a gardener who came here, and my daughter was the one who told him what we wanted to have done, the little garden that you just saw as you entered. And then my daughter she went off to the Soviet Union to do her doctorate. The way our professionals went to the Soviet Union for doctorates was that they continued, they graduated from the university here, and then they continued, they began working, then they continued to be paid the half of their salary. If the family needed the whole salary, they would give them the whole salary. If, as in our case, we didn't really need it, they got paid half their salary every month. And then they were sent to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union took care of them and gave them their stipend, their money and everything, and made them doctors mm-hmm. in science. So my daughter went off, and then the next time that the gardener came by, He said, I went and told him what we needed. And then he said, and where is the señorita? Because they would still call them the señorita, you know. And I said, oh, she's off to the Soviet Union. What is she doing there? She's studying. And then he says, I have a daughter studying in the Soviet Union. Now, that would have never happened before the revolution. I mean, no gardener's daughter would ever have had any kind of scholarship to go study anywhere. His hands were with big, big, big calluses like this, and he had no teeth. But his daughter was doing the same thing my daughter was doing. So those are the things that you feel, you know. And
what was your daughter studying in the Soviet Union?
She's a doctor in biology, mm-hmm. like my son. My son is also a graduate of the Soviet Union, a doctor. They studied their regular university course here, and then they went to the Soviet Union for 4 years or 3 years, and then they would come maybe once or twice in between, because even the travel expenses, we were not supposed to pay for them because we didn't have foreign currency exchange. Mm-hmm. Our salaries, my husband and my salaries, were very good, but we couldn't pay for their trips because we didn't have that much to change. So they came, my daughter came twice in that 4 years and a half, and that was very hard for us.
Rosa Antich-Coro, professor of English at the University of Havana, speaking from her home there when I went down to Cuba last week. We'll continue with Dr. Antich in just a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with our conversation with Dr. Rosa Antich-Coro, professor of English at the University of Havana, ideologist with her local neighborhood committee in defense of the revolution, as she talks about her life over the last four decades in Cuba.
Is this the house you grew up in?
No, but it's very similar. I grew up in an apartment on G and 25th, which is only about 7 blocks from here, a huge apartment. It was a very fashionable apartment house when we first lived in it. Now it's okay, it's acceptable, but it's old. And as it happened, we went to for the New Year's Eve, we went to have dinner at a cafe restaurant that is right across the street from where I was born and raised. So that was interesting. I've lived here all my life. So we moved then. I moved to a smaller house when I got married. My parents continued living in the apartment. Then I moved to a normal apartment, two-bedroom apartment. Then as the children came, then we got a house similar to this one. And then later we permuted. You know about permuting, don't you? Well, how does a Cuban move? There are no houses available. There are no houses for rent. There are no landlords, only tenants. One of the laws was that you would be given the house in which you lived. So, for instance, the people who owned this house before I moved here owned about 12 or 13 houses in another street. And then all those houses were given to the people who were living in them. But the owners got paid a very acceptable amount of money, which was in that case up to 600 pesos, which was a lot of money then, a month for so many years. Really practically until they died off, you know, the older people were the ones who owns. Well, anyway, as it turned out, what you do is then that you exchange. You want a bigger house with so many bedrooms and so on, or you or in another part of the city or whatever, mm-hmm. and somebody wants the type of house you have, which is a very primitive way of doing it. It's very hard. At first, when we had enough newspapers, you published it in the classified ads. I need, and I can, what I have is, and that way people came to see your house, they walked all over your place, and that's not very pleasant. But then you exchanged. So we exchanged houses twice, my husband and me, using that system. There was no other.
So you were 37 when the revolution happened. And what did you and your husband then do? What were you doing before, and what did you do after?
I taught in a private school for the higher middle class. I taught English there, not just English language. We taught, bilingual school. So they had everything in English in the morning and everything in Spanish in the afternoon. And I had been teaching there a long time, and my husband was a medical doctor. He had his office, since the beginning of the insurrection, we were for Fidel, and we knew what he was doing, and we had read History Will Absolve Me, so we knew what he aimed to do.
And Fidel and Castro wrote History Will Absolve Me when he was in prison?
Yes, he wrote it when he was in prison, and it was not widely known. In fact, we hadn't read it. We knew what his program was. Mm-hmm. We knew about it. And so we were very much in favor of it. We were a teacher and a doctor. And being a teacher, you're ideal if you're an idealist in your profession. You want all the children and all the people to have school and to learn. And if you're a doctor, you want everybody to have medical attention, not to have to pay for it, and to have medicine and so on. And that's exactly what the program was. So how could we not be for the revolution if it was going to procure those social changes? We did mix with the higher sphere of society. We had many rich friends. We went to all these fashionable weddings and all these, birthday parties and things like that. But we knew by then that that was very wrong. I mean, that that kind of society would lead nowhere. And so we knew that things had to be done. And we gave ourselves completely. Before the revolution, while we call the insurrection period, when Fidel was in La Sierra, we did some clandestine work, not very much. We did some. We had, like, for instance, collecting medicines to send to La Sierra and things like that.
And for listeners who aren't familiar with La Sierra, that's the Sierra Maestra, which are the mountains where Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and others
had their guerrillas, yes. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Where they were fighting, where they were based.
Uh-huh. So we would do that, and we hoped and wished very much that Fidel would triumph. Immediately after the triumph of the revolution, we gave ourselves to revolutionary work completely. And as far as we are concerned, I can tell you that we lived very well before the revolution, and we have not lived well after the revolution. And we haven't had one single law materially that has benefited us at all. We had the urban law that took away whatever property my father had. We had the agrarian reform, which took away the other property. And every single thing has been a little bit against us. But the revolution was not made for us. It was made for the people who needed it. And we decided that we would work for it, that we would do as much as we could for it, because we had had enough before. And we were very proud to have our children, our young boys. Rosy, my daughter, was only 7. The boys were 14 and 17. And they understood the revolution very well. And they became militiamen in the first call and everything else.
Were there many people like you and your husband?
Unfortunately, no. Not from our social class. They left.
They all left.
Well, I would say yes, that 90% of my friends left. The ones who had been in school with me. Also, many of my friends were teachers of English like I was, or like I am. So they knew the language, and it was no problem for them to go to the United States. They also had connections, friends there. They used to go there like we used to go for vacation and go to the mountains in the summer, things like that. So many of them left in general. I wouldn't say that the whole higher class left, because that would be saying too much, but I'd say that a very large proportion. People didn't want to lose their privileges. They were used to, you know, bossing around, being important, and buying good things, and so on, and they knew all that was going to stop.
What was your friend's reaction to your support of the revolution?
Well, at first, really, these days, like the 2nd of January, at the beginning, I would say that even the except for the very, very, very wealthy people, the millionaires, except for those, everybody was for Fidel. But then the new laws and the new changes began to come, and that's when they began to go back.
Huh? Well, you know, this is interesting because a lot of people don't remember back to then about how the changes took place, that they were incremental. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could explain what that was like. I mean, when Che marched in the streets of Santa Clara January 1st, and then Fidel Castro came to Havana January 8th, what was your understanding then of what was going to happen and what the government would look like, and how did things change as you went along?
Well, at the beginning, as I say, I think that 98% of the Cuban population was very much for the revolution. My personal interpretation, which is not necessarily the correct one, but my personal one, everybody was so tired of the Batista's tyranny. Tired is not the right word. They were horrified. They were scared to death. We found them murdered every day, and we lived under a state of oppression and repression and panic. So when Fidel was seen as the savior, you know, the one that got us out of that situation. So in general, for many months, even the people in the higher bourgeoisie were for Fidel. Then the first reform was the agrarian reform, and that agrarian, is it understood?
Yes.
Is my word understood? It took place on the 17th of May, and it was enacted, yes, 1959. So there go the big landowners, the big landowners there. They go with their families. They couldn't very well accept this, you know. Then they tried their best to suggest other ways of doing it to Castro's government, but that, of course, they wouldn't accept that.
That agrarian reform, what exactly did they lose? Because you're saying they didn't lose all the land, but they...
No, but what they kept was a very small portion. It was supposed to be five... I don't know the measurements, but it's a very small thing. Mm-hmm. So they were very angry. And they had forever, and they had counted that as something sacred, you know. And then, some months later, I don't remember how many, but very shortly after that, came the what was called the urban reform, and that was when landlords lost the houses. And then, if you own an apartment house, you know how much you can get from an apartment house, and then each apartment was given to the person who lived it.
When you say it was given, does that mean they no longer paid rent, or they paid rent to the state and it was much cheaper?
There were two kinds. If the building, if the place had been built for more than 20 years, you were supposed to have paid for it. So then it was free of rent. Then,
if you had lived in it for more than 20 years, you no longer had to pay.
Uh-huh. And then if that was not the case, then you paid only 10% of your family income. Mm-hmm. Family income.
And you paid it to who?
We paid it to the state. Mm-hmm. We paid it to the state. And then the big laws began to come, and then nationalization of the big enterprises. We had Coca-Cola, Swift, Standard Oil, everything. All the big companies here were American. And then one day it was announced, because these things were announced like that, you know, boom, it comes in one day. Of course, Fidel would keep saying that drastic measures would have to be necessary, but he wouldn't say exactly which. And then after they had it all prepared, then they would notify the people. And then one day they would say, all foreign enterprises will be nationalized. And that was hard. So all the people who worked in those things, not the people who worked, the close to the executives, because the important executives were always the Americans. They were the ones who lived here, who had the most beautiful homes and so on and on. And they really came here to get rich, you know. I guess they're still doing it in other parts of Latin America. And then the executives, the Cubans who were their seconds, were also horrified because they also lived very well. So that was another of the big things that were done, and so many others.
What would happen to the workers in these companies? The corporation would continue to operate, so they would still get paid, right?
Of course. I mean, the workers are the ones that are needed to keep a society going, you know. So, of course, they continued to be paid, and then they began to receive more benefits, of course. If they didn't have to pay for their medical care, if they didn't have to try to find a private school for their children because the public school was not so good, although it had very good teachers, but then the actual conditions, you know, like buildings and books and so on, if they didn't have to pay for their schooling, if they didn't have to pay for their health care, and then they became important people in our society. They had a say in everything that was being done. There were constant meetings. There were too many meetings. Meetings lasted for hours, and everybody was given the opportunity to speak up and say what he felt and what he thought and so on. And sometimes you were just dying for the meeting to be over and get home and so on. But then the workers were the most important people, workers and the farmers, of course.
The foreign enterprises were nationalized. How about the privately owned enterprises by Cubans?
That was my father. So you are asking me something that I know very well. A few maybe months, now of course my chronology is not very good, they announced that privately owned businesses, all businesses would be taken over by the government. So they were, and my father was given a 600 peso amount until he died. He died only maybe 2 years after that, but he would still be getting it if he were alive.
What did he think? What was his reaction? What was his company?
Cosmetics and soap. You know, talcum powder, face powder, lipstick. He had decided to have a very popular, very cheap products, because here we had Palmolive and Colgate, and those absorbed all the business of cosmetics and soap and things. And then, of course, there were the French perfumes and so on. So my father decided that he would have the very inexpensive ones so that anybody could buy a bar of soap or a lipstick. I remember the lipsticks were little, and they cost only 10 cents, you see? No, how did my father take it? We had prepared him for that. I mean, that didn't come as a surprise. By then, everybody knew that all private enterprises would be taken over by the state, and people were prepared for that. And then 600 pesos was a perfectly good amount of money to live on for a month, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was all right.
Did they consult with him afterwards, especially because he was somewhat sympathetic in terms of how to run the factory?
In my father's case, yes. In fact, he went on working there for a while, not going from 8 to 5 or anything like that, whenever he wanted, because he was very good at making soap. He knew the soap business. And his factory was rather rudimentary. It didn't have a high technology. It was rather old. And he knew how to handle the great big boiler and the pressure, the manometers and things like that. And so he volunteered to do that until he was able to maybe train somebody, and they were very nice to him, very, very respectful and very sweet. When he died, they all came to the funeral and so on.
But
that was not the case in every case. I mean, I can only tell about my father, but I imagine that in other cases, it would be, you know, por la fuerza, by force, they would have to take it because some people would not want to surrender their business, okay?
But you, as family members, didn't get the 600 pesos a month that he got after he died, or neither did his wife?
No need for that at all, because my mother had her own money from the things that had been taken from her, and we had our own salary, so no reason why I should inherit whatever my father was being given if I worked and had a salary of my own. That has been the general trend of the revolution. If you're a worker and you can stand on your own, no reason why you should have something else.
Rosa Antich Coro, professor of English at the University of Havana, one of the few wealthy Cubans who threw her lot in with the revolution back in 1959. She continues to support that revolution, along with her three children. In the next few weeks, as we lead up to the Pope's visit, you'll hear from her son, Arnie Coro, who is co-founder of Radio Havana, and one of those Cubans who fought off the Bay of Pigs invasion. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, another view of Cuba. Stay with us. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Carlos is a Catholic and an engineer who's critical of the revolution, at least at this point. He used to work for the government but recently quit out of financial desperation. He's 49 years old. Last week in Havana, I just walked out of a building and he and his wife were washing their car. When I asked him how I could find a taxi, he said he'd take me. We spoke for a while in the car, and then I asked if he would mind if I recorded an interview with him. He drove around for about 20 minutes, afraid to be seen talking to me. Finally, he found an area he felt comfortable with. He pulled his car over. I was sorry I didn't have a translator, but we decided his English was far better than my Spanish, and this is what Carlos, he didn't want me to use his last name, had to say.
What do you think of your country today?
My country today is very bad. It's very bad. It's very difficult to live here. The money, not easy enough, the money, for living.
You were a mechanic. You worked for the government. How much did you make a month?
When I was working as an engineer, about $10 a month.
Now you're working freelance. What do you do? You make things?
I make things, everything for get some money for me and my family.
How much do you make now as a freelance?
I can get 1,000 in a month. Another month, only 100 or 500 or 700.
Pesos?
No. Dollars.
U.S. dollars?
Dollars. With the pesos. Don't live with the pesos.
Right. 1,000 U.S. dollars, United States dollars.
United States dollars.
Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. $1,000 a month. And it is enough. The life is very expensive. All here is very expensive. Mm-hmm. The shoes, the...
How much are a pair of shoes?
How much are your shoes?
These shoes, uh-huh. My shoes now. I buy yesterday $75 with closing, $75. Another shoes maybe cost 23, 30, 40, you buy, and only left 1 or 2 or 3 months. Uh-huh. Hmm? Uh-huh. But they are very bad. No quality.
You're a Catholic.
My?
You're a Catholic.
Ah, yes, I am Catholic. Mm-hmm.
Can you practice your religion freely?
Yes. I go to the masses every Sunday, and everybody knows that I Catholic. Mm-hmm. But it is now. Before I couldn't express freely my religion.
Before when?
Maybe 1990. Maybe 90. Before periodo especial.
Before the special period.
Before the special period. Uh-huh. If the government was very strong, and if you say that you was a Catholic or another religious, you maybe you lost your work.
You lose your job.
Yes. Maybe you lost my job. Uh-huh. In when you go to the star in a job, the employer asks you if you have any religious, if you have any family in the United States, if you voted in the 1958.
Election,
Batista's election, mm-hmm. Before revolution. If you say yes, at this song question, mm-hmm. You can work.
Did you vote in the 1958 election?
No, I was a child. Huh? In this time, mm-hmm. only 10 years.
What do you think of Fidel Castro?
It's pretty mad. It's mad. It's crazy. Before, not, but now, yes.
What do you mean before, no, and now, yes?
Because he wants all the power, and this now, no works. The world has changed, and this no change, and he's no change.
Did you like him in 1959?
Yes.
Yes.
All Cuban people like Castro.
Why?
Because he gave us liberty and other possibilities, and hope. But when the time goes by, everybody was bad. Do you understand me?
You're saying as the times change, everyone starts to feel bad.
Mm-hmm, yes, I can assure you, many people, maybe 80 or 90% don't like us.
Now.
No, in the 59, everybody peoples like us. Uh-huh.
In 1970?
In the 70, maybe many peoples, about 60 or 70% like us.
In the 80s?
Less, mm-hmm. Very less. And now, I think like us, about 10% of peoples.
Do you feel you can speak freely?
No. I am afraid now.
You're afraid?
Yes. Because I don't know who are you. But afraid. But my feeling is bigger than my afraid. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Will you go to the big mass today?
Yes, I seem to go. Mm-hmm.
Did you celebrate Christmas this year?
No. It is a lie. This Christmas only was that you cannot work, but only no food, no lies, no another things that are proper of Christmas. Mm-hmm. Hmm? Mm-hmm. The peoples don't know what is Christmas. The people don't know. Only religious.
What is Christmas?
The birth of the Christos, of the Jesus.
Hmm? The birth of Jesus.
The born. Eh?
The birth.
The born. Nacimiento.
The birthday of Jesus.
The birthday of Christos, yes. Mm-hmm. That is Christmas. Mm-hmm. For me and for all.
Will Christmas be a public holiday next year and the next year?
I don't think so. Only this year for the Papa's visit. Only this year. Mm-hmm. After the Papa's go, all will be same.
All will be the same as it was before.
Yes. Cuba in the 60s is different in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Hmm? It's very different. Very different.
Before the revolution, there was a lot of poverty, a lot of hunger. Very rich people, like Batista, mm-hmm, and his friends, mm-hmm, and very poor people.
Yes, that's right.
Do you think Fidel Castro changed that?
Yes, changed that. He changed Batista for him. And he changed friends of Batista for friends of him. Hmm? It is the same.
But is it really? I mean, you're just saying change one group of gangsters for another group of gangsters. But didn't he really improve the lives of many people?
People's lives worse. Juan Batista, people life worse now, because the hospital and the schools are not all life. The life are another things. The life is liberty. The life is can talk. The life is can travel freely. The life is I have my religious. The life are another things, not only health and education.
But that's something. I mean, before, people didn't have health and education. You have to start there.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And do you think that was
as
good?
As all America Latin, huh? As all Latin American, all Latin American before 60 was very poor. Before 90, if you have $1, you received a punish.
If you have $1 and you saved it, you were punished.
Yes, you could go to the jail.
You could go to jail.
For a year for a dollar.
It was illegal to have a dollar.
The dollar was illegal before 90s. Now the dollar is illegal, and mm-hmm, many people have TB, color TB, new cars. Mm-hmm. Yeah? But that people works in corporation, in stranger enterprise.
In enterprises for foreigners.
Uh-huh. And these people are the only half dollars. these people and the jineteras. Do you know jineteras?
Yeah. Well, what, hustlers.
Yes, the jineteras are the pretty girl. Very
prostitutes.
Prostitutes. Horse, no? These people have money. These people have have money. But an engineer and a professor and a medical doctor don't money and live very bad, and to live very bad.
Do you want to leave Cuba?
I want to get out of Cuba. I think if I would live in another country, any country in the world, I would live better than now in this country. Mm-hmm. But I feel strong. I feel I want work.
You want work.
I want work in my profession. Mm-hmm. But here I can't.
What will you do during the Pope's visit?
Well, I will go to the mass in the plaza, and all that my church commanded to me.
Are you happy the Pope is coming?
I don't know. Sometimes I think it will be good, and other times I think that is worse for us, for the Cuban people.
Why?
Because the Pope, I don't know this word in English. El Papa certificará, respaldará con su visita al gobierno actual de Cuba.
Will make credible the government.
Yes, make credible. Will make credible.
Will validate.
Validity, yes.
Give validity to.
And the people's continuous life very bad.
Well, I want to say thank you for talking to me. What are you drinking? Is that?
I am drinking brandy, Tres Toneles.
What is that? Cuban?
Yes, Cuban. And yes, with dollars.
$4.
$4. The people who haven't dollars can drink that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The drinking that the people with the Cuban pesos is very bad. Mm-hmm. Very bad, very bad, very bad, very bad.
But it's not good to drink and drive, so it's dangerous.
No. Only it's a little. Mm-hmm. Only a little.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Amy. Thank you for you.
Carlos, a Catholic and an engineer, critical of the revolution, as we sat in his car by the side of the road. He was sitting with his wife, but she couldn't speak English. That does it for today's show. We're going to be bringing you more reports on Cuba, conversations in Cuba over the next few weeks as we lead up to the Pope's visit. Again, we'll be playing an interview with Rosa Antich's son, Arnie Cuero, also a historic figure in Cuba, helped to repel the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can write to us by email. Our address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Sammy Lee Webster Woog helped produce today's show. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!